Welcome, everybody, to the Blue Ridge Speakers Group. My name's Dale, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Dale.
All are welcome. This is an open meeting. Please be courteous to the speakers while they're sharing and turn off your cell phones and put them on vibrate. Those who care to, help me open this meeting with a moment of silence, followed by the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept things I cannot change, the courage to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We're self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. It's been customary that we read the last two paragraphs from Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous, page 29, and there is a solution. Reiterates the purpose of this meeting. Each individual with their personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he establishes his relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has actually happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women desperately in need will see these pages. We believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that they will be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. And Matt C. and I took a little trip, I don't know, it's been a while ago, on a Friday night, up to Potomac, Maryland, and we had a really good meeting up there on Falls Road, I believe it is, and was really welcome, a big group, and a good strong message. And up there that night, we heard our speaker tonight, Eric, and shared a story, and we really enjoyed it, we asked our speaker to get this guy to come down and share with our group a little bit of what we heard that night, and we hope you all and know you all will enjoy Eric's message. And so could you help me welcome Eric from Bethesda.
My name's Eric. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Eric.
My sobriety date, which is January 3rd, 2002. I have a sponsor and the opportunity and privilege to sponsor other men. I have a home group in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm grateful to be here tonight. I thank Matt and Dale and Sam for asking me to come out here and just carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And everything good in my life today is a direct result of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and a power greater than myself. Very personal to me. And I didn't think that would be when I arrived here a little over 10 years ago. I didn't want to get sober. I wanted no parts of the life that I live today, which is beyond my wildest dreams. But I didn't want it because I didn't know anything that it held. And I think that has a lot to do with my alcoholism, is I like to control things and control life. So I've been tasked this evening to share my experience, strength, and hope, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I was raised in a small little town in Pennsylvania, by Bedford is where I was raised at, if anybody knows it. It's not very big. By two parents that love me to death, still married to this day, actually celebrated 39 years of happy marriage yesterday. And thanks to my wife, I was able to send them a text message and congratulate them, because I am still selfish and self-centered to the core and forget stuff like that that's big in other people's lives. But there's really nothing about my upbringing that has to do with my alcoholism. My father, the big book describes him as a heavy drinker, hard drinker. I'll tell you about that a little later, but he didn't drink really alcoholically in front of me or abusive or anything like that. My mother was never a drinker, not even in her younger years, didn't really party that much. She graduated high school in 1969. And in my opinion, it's like, wow, you missed it all. You know what I mean? I was like, you had the best opportunity in the world just to party your face off and love it and get away with it. But she told me that she did not want to participate in any of that because she was afraid how it would affect her and affect her later years of having children. And I'm like, well, too bad, sorry. You know what I mean? She did everything right, and I still showed up screwed up. I still have what some people call the gene. Her father died sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, but the damage was done. He had, I think, 6 years sober when he died, but he lived a very hard life. You know, he was an alcoholic through and through. My father's father died from the illness of alcoholism, never got sober. My father's brother has 26 years sober. So the gene was kind of there for me to grasp. And I don't know if that's what makes me an alcoholic or not. Really what makes me an alcoholic is what alcohol does for me. It's not what alcohol does to me, because alcohol does the same thing it does to everybody. You know, it gets us drunk. What makes me an alcoholic is it does something for me. It relieves the insanity inside of my head. And when I was growing up as a kid, I felt different. You know, everybody says that, but I related to that for when I was new. And it's important for me to share that every time I give a talk, because I did. I felt different. I did not feel like I belonged anywhere where I was. And also, in first grade, I was not up to par with the other kids that I was in school with. So it became a consensus without my input to put me in a learning disability program. And the problem with that was it was such a small community and they really didn't have the proper thing to do with me. And looking back, which just would have held me back, I think that would have been the right thing to do. But they put me in this other school, which was involved a bus, a long short bus, is what I looked at it as. And, I'd be riding on that bus, and I would just feel different, and I'd get to this other school, and it was other kids my age. It was just a farm school. We all ended up coming together at like sixth grade there in Bedford, but it was in its own little classroom of learning disability program. But problem was, I was too smart for that program, but too dumb to be with the regular kids. So I kind of got left behind. So school was just kind of a nightmare for me because I never picked up the basics when I was a kid, English, you know, just the basic stuff. So I was always left behind and felt less than. And I don't know if that has to do with it or not, but I was insanely heady from day one. You know, if I knew what a drink did for me, I think I would have been drinking on that school bus, you know, just to relieve the insanity that went on inside my head all the time. So, you know, I went through school and struggled, and I played sports. I didn't excel really in sports, but I was a normal kid. And then at the age of 14, me and some of my buddies decided to rob a beer distributor. In Pennsylvania, you can't buy beer from a 7-Eleven or a gas station or anything like that. You got to go to a beer distributor, which is kind of an alcoholic's dream. It's just a warehouse full of beer. You know, just that's all they do is sell beer. I guess they sell some soda too. But so one of the kids' mothers worked there, and Jimmy DeLock or whatever, and we stole a whole pickup load full of beer. I'd never been drunk at this point in my life. And we took it out to one of the kids' farms that weekend, and there was four of us. And we started drinking, and I didn't particularly like the taste of beer, but I intuitively knew what it could do for me. And I just fought through it and slugged it down. And I came to in the morning, face down in the field, blacked out the night before, and I was dry, you know, dried up. And I found a cooler with alcohol in it and some non-alcoholic beverages, and I intuitively knew that if I drank alcohol, I'd feel better. And I feel the way I did last night because something occurred for me from that first time I ever drank. So I did. I started drinking beer right in the morning from the first time I ever got drunk. So right from the get-go, I'm a blackout drinker and a morning drinker. And there was really no easing into it for me. From that night, life changed. I mean, it took a drastic change. Everything else in life stopped. And you know, I think I was playing football at that time, and that was the end of that. It was the end of everything. I wanted to seek that way of life. My father owned a small little surveying business, and he employed some younger guys that I ended up starting hanging out with right away and started partying with. And life just kind of, it took off, what I thought took off, because everything I'd been, all the struggles I had in life, it seemed like were gone. You know, and I started drinking before school and going to school drunk. And I'm doing this with some of my buddies that I'd been friends with since, you know, grade school. But even though when we drink, you know, they still didn't, I could tell they didn't get out of it what I got out of it. Because they'd be, you know, we'd get a case of beer and I'd be worried that that's not enough for four guys. You know, I'm concerned that I'm not going to get my fair share. And I'm counting my beers and watching what they're doing and starting to steal some of theirs, and because it did something extra for me that it didn't do for them. And the age of 17, right after I got out of 11th grade, I rolled a truck down through a field and almost killed myself. I came to in the field, found my truck upside down in a creek, smashed. The cab was flat. And there's no real earthly reason why I stand here and tell you about that to this day. And I came to, found my truck, went back into a blackout, came to again talking to a state cop. And at that point, you know, I knew I was telling some sort of line of lie. And I just didn't know where I was at in that lie because I just came out of a blackout. And I had a mouthful of mints that I don't know where I got. And I just started spitting out mints. And the cop asked me what I was doing, you know, and that was DUI number one. And at that point, I thought it was just a round of bad luck. Took a turn way too fast. Now, I just remembered, I was talking to guys on the way down here, that I got, previous to that, a couple hours in the night previous to that, I got pulled over by a borough cop for doing something, and he let me go. He didn't give me a DUI, and I was drunk then. But, you know, normal people, I think, would say, phew, got out of that one. I should probably go home and cool off or just go home. Not me. You know, I just keep on going. So that was DUI number one. And so I'm got to go to court, lose my license for 6 months, my senior year of high school, and I'm forced to go to outpatient treatment in order to get my license back. It's one of the things. And outpatient treatment, I'm forced to go to 4 AA meetings. Not a week, just took 4 total AA meetings. But you can't do that in the town of Bedford in 1 week. It takes a little over a week because there's only 3 meetings a week. So I walk into AA, and it was in the same room I went to Sunday school with in as a kid. And it just wasn't for me. There was men much older than me in this room, and I wasn't an alcoholic. Well, let me back up. I knew from the first time I ever drank I was an alcoholic. My mom actually told me when I was a kid that if I ever chose to drink, I'd probably be an alcoholic, just because she was the mother of it or the daughter of an alcoholic, you know, and she just knew, you know, and her husband was a hard drinker. He liked alcohol. And so I knew I was an alcoholic from pretty much day one, but I didn't need AA in order to be solved the situation. My father got a DUI when I was, I don't know, about 12 or 13, and my mom was just tired of it, and she said she was going to leave him and take his kids away from him, and he stopped drinking. You know, and the big book describes him as a hard drinker, because with enough sufficient reason, you stop drinking. And he did. He hasn't had a drink since. Hasn't really cared about it. So I figured I could do that. And I was raised with the kind of understanding and that if you want something bad enough, you can do it. You know, just apply willpower and you can do it. So I was just going to stop drinking on my own. But in high school, I really didn't want to stop drinking. I wasn't ready to stop drinking. I figured I'd just try to control my drinking, and that really didn't work out too well. So I drank all the way through high school and got my license back. And about 2 months after I got my license back, I just graduated high school and hit a telephone pole that was entirely too close to the road, which I DUI number 2, and almost killed a friend of mine that ever since kindergarten. He had a seatbelt on. I didn't. I've had a couple $1,000 in dental work because of that. That was DUI number 2. And here I am, 18 now, and the law changes a little bit. And everybody I went to school with my whole life is now going to college, and I go to jail. And I'm sitting in jail, and jail offers one the opportunity a lot of time to think. And my mom came to see me, and you know, that wasn't what she wanted for her son. That wasn't who she raised, you know, but that's where I was at. And I looked, you know, I could just see the despair, and kind of she felt bad for me. And she really wasn't happy, really wasn't proud of me. And I told her that when I got out of jail, life was going to change. I was going to be different. I was going to change the way I was living. And I meant it with all my heart. It wasn't just something to make her feel better. And I got out of jail, and, you know, the only thing I changed was I stopped drinking and stopped doing everything that I was doing, except I still continued to hang out with the kids I'd always hung out with. I was still going to parties and still doing everything. I just wasn't drinking, and I was slowly going insane. And it was in the wintertime of Pennsylvania, very gray, very dark, and I stayed sober, dry. I stayed dry for 3 months, something like that, a little over 3 months. Springtime came, and I was riding around with a buddy of mine, and he was smoking some outside substances, and it smelled good, and I was just tired of being insane. And so I joined him, and we quickly went to get a case of beer, and that was on a Friday afternoon, and on Sunday evening I came to in Northern Maryland somewhere, and that's the way it is for me. It's that quick. And my parents knew that what happened, and I think they were just expecting it to be a matter of time. And with my second DUI, I had to go back to the AA meetings and back to inpatient treatment. And I remember the inpatient treatment counselor was not one of us. She went to school to do counseling or whatever it is they do, and she had no experience with the true illness of alcoholism. And I remember her telling me that I need to find a hobby. Maybe I can play volleyball. And I'm like, volleyball? Really? And I just remembered this. I was giving a talk a couple weeks ago, and it came out. And my dad picked me up from that session or whatever it was. And he could tell something was wrong, you know. And he's like, "What's wrong?" And I was just at the despair of life, you know, just like, "Really, volleyball? That's how I'm going to fix this problem?" You know, and that's, I'm like, "That's the best they can give me." And thank God there's more to sobriety than volleyball. But I went to 4 meetings, AA meetings. Nothing changed. Still didn't really need AA. But definitely didn't know what I was going to do. But anyways, I picked back up and I start drinking again. And I end up going to college. And I really don't remember a whole lot of college. It was kind of just a steady blackout. Except I was out from underneath my parents' roof and it was on. You know, anything that was presented to me and given me the opportunity to do, I did. And I don't regret any of that because that experience has offered me the opportunity to help other men. But I don't remember a whole lot of it. I somehow graduated college. My father raised me with a very strong work ethic that, you know, his philosophy was you can do whatever you want to do, but you better be to work on time. And I applied that same philosophy to college. And I went to class somehow, a lot of times very inebriated. I found a lot of other outside substances that helped me still show up for life. But my illness took on a whole new life. And I was drinking every day and doing other stuff every day, all day. And there was really no break. And something pretty important in my story is before I had that first DUI, I was raised in a Presbyterian church. Not really, didn't go to church every day, but my mom did her best to try to introduce me to the Bible and a God. And I truly felt that there was no purpose or reason for me to be here on this earth whatsoever. Like, I had that conscious thought. Like, I'm very insignificant in this world. There's no reason for me to be here. There's no purpose. And I got that first DUI, and the day after, they towed my truck back to my house, and I remember looking at it the next day from a sober set of eyes and just saying that there was absolutely no reason I survived this accident. There's got to be a point and a purpose for me to still be here. I just got thrown out of the truck. And ever since that day, I believed that there wasn't a purpose for me to be here on this earth. I still don't know what it is, but I believe, you know. And from that day, I started believing that there was a God. And I didn't completely change my way of life because that was obviously DUI number one. And there was another one to follow. And shortly here in the story, there was another one after that. And I hit my knees, or I don't think I hit my knees. I prayed. I remember praying to God right at the end of college. What do I do after I get out of college? Where do I go look for work? I went to college for heavy equipment, moving earth, basically civil site excavation, putting in pipelines. I wanted to be a pipeliner. So I wanted to know where to go look in the country for work. Like, where do I take this next chapter of life? And within a week of saying that prayer, I got DUI number 3. And now I know that was God answering my prayer. I'd get sober. And I really wasn't happy about it. I came to the next morning after that DUI and had the familiar feeling of handcuffs on the wrists. Because for me, I had a complete inability to be polite to a police officer when I was drunk. I don't know if anybody relates to that, but I couldn't do it. I don't know why. So I got beat up a lot by cops, roughed up. And we were just talking about that, too. After my first 2 DUIs, I decided that I'll never get another DUI again because I'll just refuse all the tests and they won't be able to charge me with a DUI. That might work, but you got to keep your mouth shut. You got to act sober. I didn't act sober. I was wasted. You know, and I asked them to send a police report to my college address, but they sent it to my dad, and my dad called me up a couple weeks later and he said, "You got something to tell me?" You know, and he read me the police report over the phone. I'm like, "Oof. I don't think I'm fighting that one." And, yeah, it was DUI number 3. So this is at the end of 2001, and here I stand. What do I do? You know, what? And my sober uncle called me up and said, "Here's a phone number for the rehab where I went to and got sober." Asked for a guy named Jack, and good luck, click. And that's kind of the way my family works is, if you want something, you got to work for it yourself. Nobody ever gives anybody anything in my family, which I'm glad. And so I call up this guy, Jack, and it's right before the holidays of 2001. And he says, well, let's get you in here before the holidays because holidays are a risky time to stay sober. And I didn't want to stay sober at this point in time. I had no desire to stay sober or stop drinking. And I'm like, that's a little rash, don't you think, Jack? So January 3rd, 2002, we set the date for me to go to rehab. And the holidays, I lived them up. I partied. But the whole time in the back of my head, I'm in fear. Like, what is going to go on with life? What's going to happen? And I kept thinking back to that 3 months of what I thought sobriety was after the second DUI, and I didn't know how I was going to go the rest of my life living like that. And I'm 21 at this point, almost 22, 3 months away from being 22. And, you know, I'm like, I finally get to the point to where I'm legal to drink. And I remember talking to my dad about that, and he's like, you ruined your drinking privilege long before you turned 21. You ruined that. He's got a point. And so January 3rd, 2002, we swing by I get in the car with my dad to go to rehab. It's a 4-hour trip. And we swing by the mailbox, and I surrender my driver's license to the state of Pennsylvania for the third time in my life. You know, in about 4.5 years. A year and a half of them were suspended. So we go to, you know, I'm all the way to rehab, and I'm thinking, how am I going to go the rest of my life without ever picking up a drink? How am I going to do it? Do I? Well, who wants to live that kind of life? Well, why even? I never really was one to contemplate suicide, but who wants to live life like that? What's the point of even living life? So I get to rehab, and I explain my thoughts to them, and, you know, and I meet this guy, Jack, and Jack says, just while you're here, however long it may be, just let it go. Be open-minded. First of all, you don't have the rest of your life to worry about. You only have today. Today is a guarantee. Tomorrow is not. And for me, that made a lot of sense. So I, you know, in rehab, they gave me a big book about Alcoholics Anonymous, and they suggested I read the first 164 pages. They suggested I pray morning and night and develop a relationship with a God of my understanding. And anybody that's been to rehab knows that it's just nonstop meetings and sessions, whatever it is. It's just nonstop, like, kind of therapy. But thank God they brought in AA. People brought in meetings from outside. And I got to see a better picture of Alcoholics Anonymous other than the one in Bedford there. And a little bit of hope transformed. On day three, I hit my knees and I had a chat with God. And it's really more of a bitch session than a chat. I just put it all out there, and I was blaming God for everything wrong in my life and why am I here and everything, all the DUIs and why, and who am I praying to, what are you, what is this, you know, the whole time in fear my roommate's going to come in the room and see me on my knees praying, just complete insanity going on inside my head. But I have this prayer, and I get up from my knees, and shortly thereafter, I just felt like everything was going to be all right, and I was in the right spot. Like, I was where I was supposed to be. And I was having a real pity party for myself in my head at this point, you know, that third DUI, getting ready to lose my license for a long time. And for me, with the work that I do, that's a huge problem. And also, at this point in time, you know, I remember being outside smoking a cigarette, and they came to find me and told me I had a buddy or something in rehab. You get a buddy to show the new guy around or whatever. So I go down and I find this kid that's in four DUIs, broken back, broken neck, broken legs, 2 years older than me. It's kind of like God saying, keep it up, and that's what you're going to be. You know what I mean? Keep feeling sorry for yourself. And it hit me. You know, I was able to see that. Thank God. So, you know, I'm 2 weeks in rehab. Very intense. Very educational. I don't know if I'd be here today without it. Grateful for it. They called me in. They said, your insurance is going to stop paying. Is there anybody you can call to help you stay longer? And I said, you going to give me a form or something that says I completed rehab? And they're like, yeah. I said, I'm done then. You know, because I didn't want to stay there. I didn't want to be there. What I really needed was to build a case to go to court with to show the judge that I was trying to change my way of life. And I'm still not knowing if I want to stay sober or not. So my dad comes and picks me up. And first good decision I made that I believe why I'm still sober today is before I went to rehab, I was going to move back into my college apartment after I got done. But we swung by there, grabbed some of my stuff, and I moved back in with my parents. We went back to their house. And I don't think I'd be sober. I don't think I would have stayed sober if I wouldn't have done that. So, and the agreement was if I, you know, I got to be sober to live with my parents. So I was on a Thursday night. Thursday night they have a meeting in Bedford. And I went back to the church where I got introduced to AA for the first time and walked into rooms and it seemed like nothing changed. And I'm sitting there and we have the meeting. And at the end of the meeting they asked if anybody was there for their first meeting. And everybody just turns around and kind of looks at me, starts grilling me. And I'm like, well, it's not my first AA meeting. I'm new. I just got out of rehab. But, you know, thank God. Because I was at a place to where I was completely filled full of fear. And I was not going to ask for help. I was not going to stick up my hand and say, I need help. I'm scared to death. In a big, like, you know, where I go to meetings at now, there's easy, you know, my home group has over 300 people in it. And sometimes, you know, I can easily would have walked to the back of the room, judged everybody there, judged the speaker, and walked out before anybody could talk to me. Scared to death. Who knows if I'd have went back the next week. So, a guy, you know, people start coming up to me afterwards and give me their numbers. They pass around the meeting list with number sheet on it. And funny, where I got sober, they had, it was an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper with the meetings for three counties on it, the steps, the traditions, and a place for phone numbers. So, it wasn't a whole lot of meetings. I think at that time there was four meetings a week. And I learned in rehab about this 90-90 thing. And I'm really trying to build a case to go to court, make it look good. So a guy comes, it's tomorrow night's Friday night. They don't have a meeting in Bedford on Friday night. And a guy come up to me and he asks, you know, and I said, you going to a meeting tomorrow night? He said, I don't know. I think so. And this guy was a tugboat captain, and he worked like a month on and 2 weeks off or something, and it just happened to be he was in town for the 2 weeks. So I asked him, you know, if I go to a meeting. He gave me his cell phone number and told me to call him the next day. I go to work the next day, and one guy, a really good friend of mine that I partied with all the time, I'm working with at this point, and he asked me what I'm doing tomorrow that night, Friday night, and I said, I'm going to give this guy a call, and if he picks up, I'm going to go to a meeting. If not, I'll see you at the bar. And that is how much I cared about being sober at that point. That is how much I really cared. The guy picked up his phone, obviously, thank God, and drove 30 miles to pick me up, and then another 30 miles to the meeting, and then, you know, 60 miles back. You know, and the meeting sucked. You know, what I thought it did, it was full of very old people with hearing aids that would not stop beeping. And the car ride was miserable because it was him, one of his sponsees, and me in the back seat just thinking, really? Friday night? For the rest of my life? This? Really? And but thank God, because that kept me sober till Saturday and the next day. And we get, so at this point I'm looking for a sponsor and I'm looking for a guy that can, looks like he can write me a nice letter for the judge. You know, not really a guy to take me through the steps. So there was a guy that just, that retired to Bedford County, that got sober in where I live at now, the Bethesda area. And he actually had AA in Bedford going. He was sponsoring guys. He was talking about the book. He was actually installed a step meeting there on Saturday nights. And he actually had a turnaround. And so I asked that guy to be my sponsor. And he does what we do, I guess. And he got me in the book right away, started taking me through the steps. And, you know, I remember sitting in his house basement one night to do my first step, I think, and it just wasn't clicking. And I think a week or two later, I don't know, at some point, I called and asked, it was on a Sunday, and I called him Sunday afternoon and asked him where we were going for a meeting that night because we had to travel. And he said his kids were in town, he wasn't going to go to a meeting, I should call this guy, Will. Well, I was scared to death of Will. I didn't. Will was very unapproachable. Will wore a cowboy hat, dark sunglasses in the meeting, and he just wasn't very, you know, approachable guy. You know, just kind of grunted at you, really didn't say hi. So I'm like, I don't want to call Will. You know what I mean? And he says, well, if you want to go to a meeting, you're going to call Will. You know, I think Will's going to a meeting tonight. So I call Will, and Will says, yeah, I'll come get you. You know, and he comes up and picks me up, and I open up the car. His passenger's, you know, size, full of coffee cups and cigarette packs, and I'm just like, really? You know, so I get in this car, shuffle in, and we go over the mountain to a meeting. And quiet the whole way, and he's Native American. We're listening to Native American and 80s music, and I'm just, you know, heady at this point. And we sit through the meeting, and on the way back, I don't know what inspired me to do it, but I start telling Will everything that's been going on inside my head my whole life. Stuff that I really felt that I was the only person that ever thought that way or felt that way. And I could see it in his eyes that he completely understood exactly the way I felt and the way I thought. And then he proceeded to tell me so. And then he proceeded to tell me what I have is alcoholism. And there's a solution for it, and it's in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And up to that point, I might have been a month sober, a month and a half sober, I can't remember, but I really didn't relate to being an alcoholic. I didn't get it. And on that car ride, I got it. And he dropped me off that night, and he said, thank you. And I'm thinking, why are you thanking me? You know, it's your car. You took time out of your life to pick me up to go to a meeting. Because, you know, it's still all about me. You know, I'm the one that needs to go to a meeting. I get it now. Completely get it. Because, and, you know, part of the step, to do a 12-step, you got to give this thing away. You got to take another guy through the steps. You got to help another person. And in Bedford, you just can't do that every day. You know, where I live at now, you can't throw a rock without hitting a newcomer. Everywhere. They're everywhere. But in Bedford, it doesn't work like that. And that's why it was so grumpy. You know, he couldn't finish the steps. And, you know, I switched. He started taking me through the steps, and I was with him pretty much in his car every day. And, you know, he started getting sober, almost for a sense. You know, he only had like a year and a half sober at that point. But to me, at that time, that was a long time. And I truly believe that God put me in his life and God put him in my life because we were a perfect fit. You know what I mean? You know, I ended up going to court and lost my license for 6 years. And they gave me house arrest. They didn't send me to jail. But my house arrest was in my old college apartment, which was interesting. And, you know, it was I moved back in right at the end of the semester. And it was insane. I don't know how I stayed sober other than the power of prayer and meetings. They let me go to, I think, 4 meetings a week or something like that. But I stayed sober right in the thick of it. You know, anything was there for me to get. It's not like I would have to search hard for it. But I stayed sober through that. You know, and I got out and I finished up my house arrest and I moved back in with my parents again, knowing full well that I didn't know how long it was going to be till I could get out of that town because it's a small town mentality. And once I surrendered, moved my probation back to that town, I knew they were just going to be like, we got them again. You know what I mean? They do. They have control over you, whatever they want. And I was willing to do that because I knew that if I stayed in my college town, which was I thought about doing it, I wouldn't have stayed sober. And that was also my first experience with different AA, bigger meetings in AA, but also first experience with a little young people's group. It was on Friday night at 10 o'clock, and I'm thinking how, you know, up to this point, I'm reading The Grapevine. I was a big subscriber to The Grapevine when I was new, very happy that it exists. I don't read it now, but it's small towns, small rural areas like that. People need it. You know, and I'm reading about these young people in AA and seeing, you know, just all the stuff that they're doing, you know, young people's conferences, living with young people in AA, just like, I'm like, really, I want that life. Does that exist? You know, so I see this little young people's group, and they're kind of doing the same thing. But anyways, I moved back to Bedford and, you know, get back with Will, and I still haven't done a 4-step yet. And I'm 7 months sober, something like that. And we go to Sessions by the Sea right after I get back, and you know, I've never seen that many people in Alcoholics Anonymous at that point. It's huge. 4,000 people or something like that, but at the time it seemed huge. And there's young people running around everywhere, which I now know is currently my current home group, you know, but I didn't know it at the time. And they're passing out flyers for this dance, and I want nothing more to go to the dance, but I'm too scared to go to the dance, you know. I'm like, no way, I'm not going to that. But, you know, I want it, and I'm still tight. You know, I haven't really done the steps. You know, I know what my problem is, and I've developed a relationship with the power greater than myself, and I'm, you know, accepting the fact and turning my will and my life over to him, but I haven't got into the dirt of why I'm like this. And a whole year goes by where I'm like this, and I start slipping, you know, in my head mentally, falling into what I thought was depression and like that, because it's just constant thought of myself, and there's still nobody really for me to help. It's still small AA meetings. I'm still with Will, you know, we're going to his sponsors every Friday night. That was a big deal on a Friday night, was to go to two meetings. It was to go to a 5:45 and then an 8 o'clock meeting, hang out with the sponsor afterwards. And his sponsor was Native American too, and there was some spiritual thing going on there I didn't really know, but I don't know what occurred there, but it changed me definitely. I went back a couple years sober and sat on that same couch and could feel it's just a spiritual something going on inside that house. But anyways, I go a year later, year and a half sober, still haven't done the fourth and fifth step, and I'm at a young people's, not a young people's convention, it's actually an NA convention in the woods. People are camping, meetings all day. And I see kids my own age just free. I see they got something I don't got. And I'm jealous of it, you know, because I am still shy, self-centered to the core. And I'm just eaten up by it. And I go back and I talk to my sponsor, and he says, well, yeah, they're doing their steps, man. They've probably done a fourth and fifth step. You should try it. And I'm like, really? That's it? He's like, yeah, I've been telling you that for a year. So Sessions by the Sea is like the next week, and we're planning on going. So I go home, you know, and I pray, and I do my fourth step. You know, what's it take, an hour, something like that? Not long. And we go to the beach Saturday morning, whatever sessions, and I do my fifth step. And there really wasn't that much to it, just free. And, you know, then I 6 and 7. But then shortly after that, I moved to Tampa. And right before I moved to Tampa, I asked them to email me mail me a meeting list. And they sent me up this book, you know, it's like 20 pages long of all the meetings. And I told you the meeting list where I got sober at. So I'm like, wow, you know what I mean, all these meetings. At this point, I want to be sober. I'm high on AA. And then also at some point, it hit me that there is, if I pick up a drink again, I will guaranteed get another DUI. In the state of Pennsylvania, I would have lost my license forever, for life, no more. And that was a compelling fact to help me get sober. For me, that was a big push. But so I want to be sober, and I moved to Tampa, and I'm in Tampa, and I find this little young people's group. You know, there was about 1,000 of them, girls and guys. And I hang out with them. It was my 2-year anniversary, and I go hang out with them afterwards at the one guy's house. And nothing special. And at that point, previous to that, I've been in Tampa for about 2 weeks, and I was starting to be in fear of, did I do the right thing? Am I in the right place? My sober uncle owned a hotel in Tampa, so I had somewhere to go. That's how I ended up picking Tampa. And he let me stay in one of his rooms until I could find a place to live. So anyways, I'm with these guys after the meeting, and they're sitting around talking about sponsorship, doing the steps, service work. And I can just tell that I know I'm in the right place. Because I've been around young people in AA at that point in my life. But a lot of young people in AA still live in the old way of life in AA. And I didn't want that anymore. I wanted to be sober. I wanted to live a sober way of life. That's what I wanted. So I found this group of young people living a sober way of life. And and about a year, I ended up moving in with two of the guys, because two of the guys that were from my home group up here moved down there, started that home group, and then moved back. So I moved in with the other two guys sober. I think I had 2 years sober. They had a year and a half or something like that. So there, we're all living together. None of us were really sponsored, because I'm still talking to Will from up here. I never got a new sponsor, and they're trying to talk to their sponsor, and I moved away. So we're kind of living life unsponsored. It was a very crazy summer, but very fun. And they ended up, his sponsor told him to bid for a conference, a young people's conference. And we ended up doing that, so we ended up getting involved with service. And through that process, we started attracting other young people. And then through that process, I was given the opportunity to start sponsoring guys. And that's what, you know, to take it all back to Will, that's what this thing is all about. I started being able to take guys through the steps and to give this thing away that was so freely given away to me. And, you know, I've had the opportunity to see guys become sons again, become brothers again, become productive members of society. And it's priceless. There's no other gift like that in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I ended up getting a new sponsor down there who was a Buddhist, believed in, you know, was following the Eastern religion, that path. And he started kind of teach me on that because I was very interested in it. And I picked this guy because he just had a peace about him that was unbelievable. And he was on his second round of sobriety. The first time he had 13 years sober and got hit by a drunk on his Harley. And those 13 years he was sober, he wasn't really seeking spiritual way of life. He was seeking materialistic items. You know, he was a stockbroker and just seeking money, 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 money. So then the second time around, he took a different approach to it because something happened there with that accident. And after the accident, he got twisted up with the painkillers. But so he started, you know, and he was a whole different person. That's what he used to tell me. He says, I've had the opportunity to live three lives. You know, one drunk, one first time sober, and now what I consider to be the best life of all is this second time around. And truly a life of selflessness, trying just to truly help others. And it's not about me. It's not about money. It's not about any of that stuff. It's just about being peaceful today with no matter what's going on in life. And you know what I mean? He's since passed. He died a little shortly after I moved up here. But, you know, I can't repay the debt of the life that guy's given me. And, you know, it's just like why I'm in here in a suit tonight. It's because, you know, people before me that God blessed my life with, you know, guides on this journey. And, you know, some sponsors, some just old timers. But I feel very blessed that God put these men in my life. And, you know, some of them were friendly. Some of them were just brutally honest. And, you know, and thank God. You know, because they didn't care about my feelings, which I'm glad they didn't. They just straight up tell me where I'm not living life correctly, or I'm not doing the right things. And I wouldn't be here today without all of them put in my life. And, you know, I was told when I'm asked to speak or do anything for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I suit up and show up and look good doing it, you know. And I can't stress the fact that I, you know, 10 years sober, still need lots of help. You know, still need people put in my life. And anyways, 3 years ago, four years ago, God, a girl that lived up here was down there visiting friends that were part of my home group. Ended up hitting it off. We dated long distance for about a year, and I moved up here and asked her to marry me. And I've been up here for the last 3 years. It's been an interesting place to live and be sober. You know, now that 20-page meeting list turned to, I don't even know how big. Now I don't even look at a meeting book. It's all online, you know. It's 10 years in that long sober, but a lot has changed in 10 years. I didn't have a cell phone for my first 2 years sober. Now I can't live without one. And I'm not big on all the traffic and the insanity up here, but with the state of the economy, I'm in construction. And you know, that's another part of my journey. I spent 6 years without a driver's license. And before that, I could not ask for help. I could do it on my own. I didn't need help from anybody. And you take my driver's license away in a small town like that where there's no public transportation. If I need to go somewhere, I got to ask you for help. And I had to learn how to ask everybody for help. And you want to talk about, for me, a humbling action. That is huge. And that I can't find God with my ego still roaring. And I need humility. For me, I'm getting a little better at it, but I'm still not great at it, of just seeking out humble actions. That's not something I sign up for every day. You know what I mean? My ego is still there. And God helps me find humility. And usually through painful actions. But I'm able to see it a lot better. At first, I'd be angry that God is doing this in my life. But I wouldn't be sober today without it. I need humility in my life. And so 6 years, you know, I moved to Tampa. I don't have a driver's license. I don't need anybody. You know, and I don't think I would have made the relationships that I have today without that. Because I find myself a lot today with myself alone in my car going to a meeting. I was never alone for the first 6 years of my sobriety. Ever. I was always in the car with somebody. And I don't think I would have got this thing because why would I have called Will to ask me to go to a meeting? I would have drove myself to that meeting. And I never would have got that. So, you know, I've learned to accept that life isn't about me. Life sometimes has some painful stuff, but it's really the way I look at it. Do I choose? If I call it bad, it's going to be bad. If I call it good, it's going to be good. But it doesn't mean it's bad. It's just not the way I want it to be if I call it bad. It doesn't conform to my plan, the way I want life to be. And a couple years ago, I don't know when it was or I don't know what happened. Somebody probably told me. But I believe my primary purpose here on earth is to be of maximum use to God and my fellows. And that's it. Nothing else. Life is not about how much I can get, you know, what I can make life to be. None of that crap matters, even though it does in my head, but it doesn't matter. And it shouldn't matter, because that's not my purpose here on life. My purpose is to be of use to God and my fellows, and that's it. And when I can live a day with that mindset, I have a great day. When I live a life of a day of what can Eric get today, sucks. You know, because it's never enough. Life is never good enough. And the funny thing was my first 2 years sober, I thought were miserable. I really did. I just thought they were horrible because I was living with my parents. Life was slow. I thought life was wasting away. I was in my early 20s. And it was just very dull and very inactive, one could say. So, and I wanted anything but to be there. And if you could have asked me back then what I want to be happy, it was to be married to a woman that loves me, to have a great job, and to have a home group and a fellowship full of people that love doing Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have all those things today. Am I happy? Hell no. You know what I mean? I look back at those first 2 years sober and I'm like, man, I had it made. I didn't have nothing to do. I didn't have no responsibilities. I didn't have no bills. No traffic. Just life was easy. So the biggest lesson I got to try to remember to teach myself is if I can't find happiness now with what's going on in life, I'll never find happiness. Ever. Because now is all I got. I don't have tomorrow. Yesterday's done. All I have is the present moment. And it's what I make of it is whether I'm going to be happy or not. And happiness isn't a destination. It's a thought. It's really just looking at life and seeing the gratitude of it and trying to see the good in everything, whether I call it bad or not. And Alcoholics Anonymous and the men that have been put in my life to help me, I've been able to see that and I've been able to get there. And it's my responsibility to try to give that away and to try to help other men see that and to try to continue to live this way of life. So I'm grateful to be asked to come out here and share this message, and thanks for letting me share.